Hello and welcome to Science Unscripted. It's Connor here.
And Gabe.
Going to start with an email from Marcus, who is a Brazilian history teacher and researcher in philosophy. He goes on to say that he listens to Science Unscripted every week, and he has an answer or something to say about a question that we posed at the end of our last episode. It was, to what extent should you simplify science at the risk of being slightly inaccurate versus being totally accurate and dry?
Yeah.
And almost so nuanced that it's difficult to have a conclusion. He says, I think you should prioritize being scrupulous, that being the most important cognitive value that you pursue, but without excluding considerations about simplicity, communicability, and comprehensibility. I think we can have both. I just don't know how much effort and extra work it will demand of you. If the question, now get ready for this, Gabe, because I had to look this up. If the questions are disjunctive exclusive.
What does that mean?
According to this definition, a disjunction that is true if only one but not both of its arguments are true.
Yeah.
It's a more complex way of saying if you have to choose one.
We are at the crux of the problem, right? In an analysis of this very sentence, that is probably the most accurate way to describe yourself and the predicament we're in. However, I don't know what that means. And we got a lot of people writing in on this. Most people said, yeah, be scrupulous. And one guy said, to the extent, your capacity, on the one hand, your capacity, are you able to devote enough time and energy into figuring out the studies to their absolute core, on the one hand? And on the other hand, the capacity of your listeners to understand it.
Or ourselves.
Or, yeah.
To be a relevant bridge between researcher and listener. Yeah. No, yeah, this kind of gets meta within the email itself, mm-hmm. a meta discussion of it, because if the questions are disjunctive exclusive, which I believe means if you have to choose one,
yeah.
then he says, quote, be scrupulous as f-. And he says, sorry, but you're welcome. For that arousal boost, Marcus, that's a wonderful reference to an interview we did on when people use swear words and how it does arouse them in the sense of making their body more alert, and which is why probably we tend to swear more often in the later part of the day and not in the earlier.
Yeah.
So thank
you. It might be a sign that he's tired. So get some sleep.
Oh, no, that would be normally be the case. I think he's just deploying this thing on purpose to wake us back up and our listeners. So thank you for that wonderful email and the complex language. I liked it.
I have one as well, an email. This is from David. This is a correction of something I said last week. I was referring to a time 50 years ago when David was at a committee meeting. He was at the University of Saskatchewan. This is when the moment he decided to stop smoking. I said it was because he couldn't sleep. That was wrong. He wrote to us to correct me, and it was the fact that there was nobody smoking in their leisure time during this retreat in these cabins. Nobody was smoking. And the clarity of that moment that he doesn't need to either. If these people, because at that point in time, everyone was smoking. It was pervasive. It was ubiquitous. Everyone was smoking everywhere. These people weren't. And he was given a couple of days to just ponder that, be aware of it. And from that moment on, he realized that he would never smoke again because he didn't have to.
I can feel that moment where, I don't know, imagine you go to a work conference and you expect all the colleagues to go out drinking afterwards, but instead something else. A very fun, sober activity happens, and you're like, oh, yeah, don't need to have that.
But think about what you need for that moment to happen. You need time. He was given time. I've gotten over another addiction in the past. I was given time to do that. And sometimes that's a tip right there for anyone struggling with it or looking for somewhere to start. Take some time to deal with it.
Mm-hmm.
One more quick one before we get to our studies. Christina wrote this, and this was written to me, Connor. I am so grateful you mentioned that you don't sleep in the same bed as your wife. Because
of snoring.
Because you snore.
Yeah.
Right? And then she says, I can't tell you how crazy I think it is that people are hung up on this. I've gotten the same reaction as you have, and I just don't get it. There's nothing more important than a good sleep. I mean, sleep deprivation is a form of torture, and if anyone has ever been sleep deprived, they know it's not great for relationships. Power to the people who can sleep all mangled up with each other, breathing each other's CO2. Haha, good point, Connor. That was your point. I love that. But for a lot of people, it would be so much better if we ditched this archaic notion, and she's referring there to our discussion of cuddling, sleeping mangled up, as she said, with your partner, and what that says about your relationship, namely that it is very good for your relationship.
It's a barometer. It's like a thermometer. So if you're snuggling a lot, cuddling a lot,
you are hot.
Things are probably going well.
Yeah.
And if not, it may be an indication that things
aren't. Freezing cold.
Yeah. There's a cold war brewing. There's something we have to discuss that we haven't discussed. Let me jump into some news here. Most people around the world, whether you want to be informed about this or not, are probably aware that one of the most prestigious universities in the U.S., Harvard University, is facing difficulties with its international students as a result of the U.S. administration kind of cracking down on that, revoking federal funding from the university, demanding information about the students. The latest I've seen, and this will probably change by the time you listen to this, but is that at the consulates and embassies abroad, there will be social media screenings looking at potential students going to the United States and seeing what their political opinions in the past on social media have been, and also attempts to restrict those student visas. This has led to the Minister of Culture here in Germany proposing that Harvard establish a university in exile, or an exile.
An outpost? A Harvard outpost somewhere here in Germany?
In Germany. And he said that, you know, Germany, which celebrates openness and diversity, would be a good host for this. I've read critics here in Germany saying, well, it's a nice thing to propose. You don't have to provide any of the funding yourself. Mm-hmm. And if Germany were to provide the federal funding or the state funding for a university for these students who can no longer, or who are finding it more difficult to study in the United States, that would take a while, obviously, to create such an institution. So the only reason I want to bring this up is, as part of this discussion, a lot of people have been very happily reminded of the fact that Harvard and many other universities, there are too many to name, provide a lot of their online courses for free.
Yeah.
That you don't have to. These are the professors.
Yale does too. Yeah.
Yeah. Many universities do this around the world, not just in English. That you can go and do not only learn from the professors themselves in the same way that they would lecture, that you'd have to pay, at least in our home country, thousands and thousands of dollars for. You can also, depending on the university itself, take quizzes or tests at the end and get a certificate. And there was just one comment I read saying, hey, it does look really great if you say I did an online course through this exclusive university and have a certificate from said university. This is a great way in a difficult job market to continue, or even irrespective of jobs, to continue improving yourself. I wanted to take something positive out of what is at the moment a difficult news story. I know I profited personally from being able to study abroad for 6 months in Spain.
Granada.
Yeah, I loved it. It enriched. It was hard. I failed a class. It didn't go perfectly, but I learned a lot. I became a richer person, I think, because I was able to do that. And it makes me sad for the young people who are finding that more difficult, or who now face uncertainty in terms of where they want to go.
Honestly, I spent my junior year abroad, and it was depressing. Probably one of the most depressing 10 months of my life.
Yeah.
I gave up my junior year of college and was sitting alone in Berlin in an apartment reading Immanuel Kant.
I had a similar experience, to be honest. But I think going through that hardship is kind of important.
Yeah, what didn't kill me made me stronger, I guess, to take some other cliche from another German philosopher. But
yeah. You've lost your friend network and you're in a foreign place. Not always as sexy
and romantic
as you think.
I gave up my prospects for a lucrative future.
Yeah.
But
you've got pictures of fingers.
Yeah, take a look at that. Take a look at that. What are you looking at?
I'm looking at two large pictures of what appears to be the same human finger, photographed twice, wrinkled. And I know a bit about the study, a tiny bit in advance, to know that it's probably wrinkled from being in water. And they've drawn with pen, digitally, I believe. They've kind of traced the contours of the wrinkled fingers.
Yeah.
So you can, they're highlighted.
I normally don't start here, but this is the title of the study. on the repeatability of wrinkling topography patterns in the fingers of water-immersed human skin. The repeatability of the topography patterns of water-immersed human skin.
How often?
This was the this was a question posed by a child to a researcher at Binghamton University in New York. When your fingers prune up because you've been swimming for too long, or you've been sitting in the bathtub for too long, does it happen the same way every time, like a fingerprint? It does.
The same wrinkled, raisiny fingers.
It does, and it raises an even bigger question, probably, at least for me. Why does that happen? Why do our fingers prune up? I thought it was because water seeps in there and swells up your finger, and that's the reason. Not at all. It's because the blood vessels underneath the skin tighten up.
Ah, because of the cooler water.
No. Because the salt concentration underneath the skin, when water seeps in there, when a little bit of moisture seeps in there, not enough to make the fingers prune up or swell, but enough gets in there, it lowers the salt concentration. And one of the functions of our autonomic nervous system, it's called the sympathetic nervous system, is when that salt concentration goes down, our blood vessels, our brain says immediately,
constrict,
tighten up right now.
Yeah, what was I saying? Because the cold water, this happens in a hot bathtub, it happens in...
Right,
in a hot tub,
it's not due to temperature here. It's part of the autonomic nervous system reacts to temperature as well, but in this case, it's salt concentration.
Salinity.
Right.
If it's diluting the salinity of my skin.
Yeah,
then
the alarm goes off in the brain, tighten them up. They tighten up the same way every time because the blood vessels are so stationary. It goes back to this researcher at Binghamton University. He was writing for The Conversation, which is it's a journalistic nonprofit. It started in Australia 15 years ago, has expanded all around the globe.
They have great articles.
These are academics writing. They're edited by journalists. It's good stuff. And it was a question way back when posed by someone from your neck of the woods, Connor, Bothell, Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Why do fingers and toes get wrinkly and change color? It led to him writing this article explaining that this is a function of the autonomic nervous system, that it happens because of the blood vessels, not because the water seeps in there. And then another kid responded and said, does it happen the same way? And that led to this study on the repeatability of wrinkling topography patterns in the fingers of water-immersed human skin.
So
and here we are now.
The landscape of your wrinkled finger will be the same. The mountains and the valleys and whatever other geographical features I could be saying right now, those are going to look exactly the same every time you get your hands wet for a period of like a couple minutes or more.
20 minutes, yeah, probably. Yeah, a couple minutes, yeah.
Yeah.
That's what we know now. Science being led by people asking questions. Kids, in this case, getting in touch, just like our listeners, get in touch with anything you guys want to talk about or know. Send us an email at su@dw.com.
That's usually how we sign off here, and I'm just going to sneak in a little more science very quickly at the end here.
Okay.
Just because it's fun. This one, very quickly, started with a sort of, not a meme post, but a visual social media post with a picture of, you can describe it, Gabe.
This is a raccoon on a clay tile on a roof, and underneath it says raccoons are not native to Germany. They were introduced in the 1920s for their pelts.
So far, this is factual. Now we're about to get into the misleading or misinformation. Keep going.
Yeah, the next sentence is, during World War II, an Allied bomb struck a raccoon farm, breaking down a wall and allowing a dozen or so to escape. Today, millions of raccoons are overrunning German cities.
There's one on the window right now, Gabe. So
That's
what got my.
I've been here for 15. I've never seen a raccoon.
I've never seen one in Germany.
And I've been here for 20 years, actually.
A friend sent this to me. Hello, Joe. You're the one who sent this to me, and with a nice question. Hey, do you have raccoons where you are?
Yeah.
No, I don't. But something seems false about this. I'm just going to mention what is false. What's interesting, I started fact-checking it. A study came out 2 weeks ago from Frankfurt.
Okay.
From a team of researchers who've been tracking for 20 years based on farmers' traps in 400 German counties. What are these numbers going up or down?
What animals are landing in these traps or what?
Raccoons,
oh,
specifically.
Oh, wow. Okay.
Somewhere between 1.6 million and 2 million raccoons in Germany. That's the most in any country in Europe, but it's far less than in North America, or far fewer raccoons in North America. Also, be skeptical, everyone listening. When you're online and you see some claim that, like, magically connects things to some dramatic event in the Second World War, be skeptical of that. In the paper itself, and I'll go ahead and read the title for anyone who wants to read it, it's called Linking Patterns to Processes Using Hunting Bag Data to Classify Raccoon Invasion Stages in Germany Since the 2000s. They make it very clear that, no, it wasn't, or they don't make it clear that it wasn't an Allied bomb. They make it clear that in the 1930s, prior to the Second World War, there was an intentional release of a couple of raccoons on hunting grounds. They probably escaped and multiplied, and things were already underway back then. Then in a town or a small city east of Berlin, there was a fur farm, and that's it. Probably, I'm speculating here, a historian can gladly correct me, but possibly as Soviet troops were advancing, or who knows what was happening, for some reason, the owners
got out.
The owners of the farm maybe abandoned it or something happened and the raccoons got out. And that'd be a huge coincidence, way outside of a major city, to have an Allied bomb land right on the wall that would allow all these raccoons to escape. That is a bogus claim, or at least one that cannot be substantiated, and I believe is less likely than raccoons just getting out.
Okay.
Do you have anything to say on probably raccoons here specifically? Any experiences with them? They are vectors of disease. Rabies is one to mention. Canine distemper, which affects dogs, foxes, coyotes, wolves, etc. Another bacterial blood infection. Avoid, stay away from raccoons. Don't touch them. Stay away from their feces and urine. Otherwise, do you have anything to say on what is a cute little creature, I think?
The Germans refer to them as Waschbären. Okay. Waschbären.
I love
just,
that.
Just take that with you to your next cocktail party and drop that little knowledge.
And send us a line. We are su@dw.com.
Have you ever wondered, I guess this one is probably directed at men, but it doesn't have to be, why female breasts are attractive? I mean, really, why? What is the reason?
It's, two lumps with nipples on them. I mean, men have this too sometimes. We do. Why would that be attractive? Why would I be sexually aroused by those two mounds? It sounds ridiculous to say these words out loud, but it's a very real question, I think, worth asking.
Science Unscripted.
Hello everyone, my name is Michał Stefańczyk and I'm a doctor of psychology, and I have just published a paper on sexual arousal and naked breasts in Papua.
Michał, before we get into this study, where exactly did you conduct it?
So Papua is an island in Indonesia. It is scarcely influenced by the Western culture, especially in the Midlands, which are just covered in hills, mountains, and quite deep jungle. And this particular society's particular population is called the Dani people, with little to no contact with the outside world.
So you looked at the Dani people and you were figuring out their levels of sexual arousal with regard to breasts. What were you looking at exactly?
In our study, when we asked the Dani people, the Dani men of different age, about the perceptions and the emotions, biological reactions caused by the view of naked female breasts, the old guys and the young guys didn't really differ from each other, but there was a significant cultural change during the last couple of decades. Namely that if you went to Papua, to that particular place in Papua 40 years ago, you would see females just going publicly naked, at least when it comes to the top part of the body. And that was a normal thing. But a cultural change started to happen. And nowadays, most females cover up completely.
So if I'm understanding you right, the older generation of men in this case, they would have grown up with topless women all around them. And the younger generation would have grown up with women covering themselves. And what you could look at there is, do they view female breasts differently as a result? Is it, I don't know, more mysterious and even more sexy because they're covered up? Or is it less? Is there a difference at all between these groups?
Well, yeah, so you are correct. This is exactly what we tested. And there were none. No differences. And we did ask a few questions.
What questions exactly did you ask?
All right. So we asked whether the men find the breasts sexually arousing, whether they we use the word fondle with, so whether they play with breasts during sexual intercourses with their partners. Is it a part of, you know, of just sexual play? And three, the question number three, whether the way the female breasts look was an important factor in overall attractiveness ratings of their partners.
What did you find out?
Well, no differences. In case of the first two questions, almost everyone responded, you know, with the top maximum, the most, you know, intense response option, which is yes, absolutely, totally. I do find it sexually attractive. It arouses me. And yes, I do, or I did, play with the breasts during sexual intercourses. So these were two of the ceiling effects. However, when it comes to this attractiveness question, whether the way the breasts look like was important for the general attractiveness ratings, we had almost a floor effect. So in this case, both old and young guys said, well, not really, it's not that really important. So basically, we here in the West, we fight over whether men like female breasts because of cultural influences. Our preliminary findings suggest that it is not about culture. It's a natural phenomenon that men like breasts, and it's not due to some sort of patriarchal cultural influences. It's just the way it is.
That leads to maybe an even deeper question, at least for me. I've read before, and I'm talking about comments on the internet, nothing scientifically researched, that Homo sapiens, human beings, are the only animal with permanent breasts. Now, obviously, other animals, other mammals that feed their young through lactation, they'll develop sort of temporary breasts as a result of milk sacs, milk forming, but that we are the only species that kind of permanently has them. Is that actually true?
Well, yes. I mean, starting from the puberty, female breasts do not really, you know, get smaller and are not, of course, they tend to get a bit bigger during, you know, becoming a mother and the lactation period. But in general, yes, they are constantly, you know, larger, which is a phenomenon not really widely spread across species.
Okay, so then why? For kind of on behalf of all the women out there who, I don't know, are annoyed by that. It's a real burden for some women out there. Is it just for the purpose of that sexual attraction? Is this sexual evolution with no other real function?
Well, there is a hypothesis that says, yes, it's basically just for the mating purposes. It's just like a signal for the potential mate, for a male, that, see, I'm, you know, just fertile, I'm ready, I'm old enough to bear children. That's one of the hypotheses. The other one is that it became easier for the child actually to get breastfed when the breasts are permanently enlarged. Some say that this is also a matter of us standing up during our evolutionary history. But in conclusion, it is not concluded. We still don't know why. They are just hypotheses, but mainly focused on the issue of mate selection.
I feel like I'm a half step away, Michael, from understanding what the practical advice would be here. Should women be walking around topless? Should men be, I don't know, have no pants on and everyone can see their penises because it doesn't matter, because it doesn't add or detract from sexualizing them? Should everyone be naked walking around? I don't think that's what you're suggesting here, but what is kind of the practical aspect of what you've just found out?
All right, so the practical aspect is that probably men like breasts, female breasts, not because of the influence of the culture, but because of our male nature. So if we consider sexualization of female breasts as a social issue, a problem, then we should approach it completely differently than we do nowadays. Because currently we usually say, oh yeah, that's the patriarchal system, that's bad, that's just, you know, a cultural thing. If we stop that, men will stop sexualizing females. It seems, at least female breasts. From our findings, it seems it's not true. So if that's a social problem, we should approach it in a different way. We should acknowledge the natural, the biological basis of this interest, sexual interest of males in female breasts.
And that was Michał Stefanczyk speaking to us from Wrocław, Poland. And he wanted us to mention that that was together with research done with Piotr Sarakowski, who was also one of the four co-authors on the study, who runs a cross-cultural team.
Yeah, looking at all sorts of different things, and this was one component of that.
At the University of Wrocław.
One important limitation of the study, we were talking to Michał about that afterwards, is what's called recall bias. So you've got an older generation of guys in this study, and they did grow up at a time where women did not cover their tops. They were topless. You could see their breasts.
These guys are 50, 60 years old at this point.
Yeah, maybe even older. And now, over the last decades, they've seen their societies become more, I guess, quote-unquote conservative in that sense, and to cover themselves. Yeah. So they may not have perfect recollection of how they actually felt decades ago with regard to the sexual arousal they felt or didn't feel when either looking at the female breast or touching it in a sexual context. That is one very real limitation of the study.
Because over time it may have changed.
Yeah, they may remember it more kind of fondly now that things have changed.
Yeah.
Or less fondly, I don't know. And what he was saying, what Michał was saying, is that a very obvious next step would be to go to a country like Angola or Kenya or Tanzania or on the border between Brazil and Venezuela and take a look at different groups there where things are happening in real time. So you have one group right next to each other. One is clothed and the other is not. And are there differences between those men now today? That would eliminate the recall bias.
Culturally, geographically, those groups are very close, but that one difference would mean that you could compare them.
Yes.
Better than asking a 60-year-old to remember what, compare your desire then to now. Kind
of thing. And so it's not a perfect study, but an interesting thing to talk about and think about, and it goes well beyond, obviously, the female breast. I mean, at one point, kind of joking with him, like, what is this? What should we do now? Should we not wear pants? Would the same happen in reverse with the male penis? If you surveyed women who were looking at nude males or non-nude males, I suppose that would be extrapolating from this study. Would that be the same? It's just strange to think about.
Yeah, what do you guys find when it comes to the dynamics of human sexual desire? Where do you stand? How important is culture or society when it comes to what we find sexually attractive? Let us know anything you want to say about breasts or any other sex organ. Send an email to scu@dw.com.
Science Unscripted.
DW, made for minds.